Following podcast contains mature language and spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Because I woke up in the middle of the night and I needed something to help me to go to sleep so I can get up and go to work tomorrow morning rather than be up until 5 o'clock in the fucking morning, I decided that, as usual, I want to be fairly blitzed when I do one of these DC Encyclopedia podcasts, because that's sort of part of the fun of it is just me being sloppy. And because I decided to treat myself this year, I actually bought a bottle of absinthe, the infamous liqueur that it supposedly in the 19th century was poisoning people and causing them to see hallucinations. All this bullshit. Unfortunately, these days, while they've brought the liquor back after having banned it for the better part of a century, it's not produced in the same way, and so I don't get the same effect. I'm not getting visions of amethyst dancing around my room or anything like that. If anything, it just makes me a little bit sweaty, which, let's face it, most harder liquors will do. But if you derive any amusement from listening to a podcast fueled partially by absinthe, you're in it now, baby. I give Batman a lot of shit, deservedly so, because he's just fucking tiresome. But I have to say, Arkham Asylum is fairly brilliant. It's so cool to have such an iconic, Victorian, completely useless, supposed institute for the mentally insane. It never helps anybody. Nobody's ever cured there. From the name alone, you know that there's a Lovecraftian quality. This is a place where madness is fostered rather than treated. Even though I was already starting to lose interest in Batman, when Batman Shadow of the Bat was released and they polybagged it with a map of a new version of Arkham, I couldn't resist buying that. And actually, I quite enjoyed that story arc. I hate Alan Grant's work more often than not, but something about that first Shadow of the Bat story arc, probably in part because you had the Hannibal Lecter stand-in, Mr. Zaz, who I have a unfortunate appreciation for. It's a character that I should have just abandoned long ago, but I even bought the damned Arkham Asylum Mr. Zaz trade. There was a collection of his greatest hits, essentially. But yeah, Arkham is just a cool fucking place, and it's a super memorable locale, and I love when comic books have this thing that really is specific to comics, where even the common man is aware of Arkham Asylum, I would think. You know, it hasn't turned out too much in the movies, but obviously from the animated series, it's well-trod train, but it's just fucking cool. It's cool to have one of these places where, despite its intentions, it's a locale of sickness. It's a locale of growing madness. It's just this place like a kind of the institution from the second Hellraiser movie. Best of them, by the way. It's neat and fucked up and terrifying to have a place like Arkham where it just breeds psychosis. The one thing that is weird about Arkham is that Joker ever wants to leave. You'd think that that'd be just a playground to him. And maybe that's why he stays there for as long as he does. Worst security of any facility ever, Arkham Asylum. So I didn't want to get too deep into the Atom, because the fact of the matter is I still have a vestigial Atom blog, and I threaten occasionally to go back and do some more episodes of a podcast related to that blog. I'm not going to lie to you and say that the Atom is one of my favorite comic characters of all time, but he's a character that I have a real fondness for from DC Comics, largely fueled from his having just a fantastic costume. I think it's one of the best costumes in all of comics. And of course, he was drawn by Joe Kane for a good portion of his career, one of the greatest comic book artists of all time. And I like that I think that shrinking is an interesting power. I think it's undervalued. I think in particular when Morrison was playing around with the Atom a lot in JLA during his run, he highlighted that. I think shrinking is one of the scariest powers in all of comics. You can do just some spooky ass shit with it. Identity Crisis would be a good place to direct people if they want to see what can be done with that power. But there's a lot of other applications. I mean, in one continuity, the Atom killed Darkseid. That's some serious shit. And I like that the Atom is a different kind of character from what I normally like. He's very much, to me, the anti-Marvel. I remember Sibio Garling, the blogger from the AbsorbusCon, had just this potentially irrational hatred of Marvel Comics, particularly the characters that are born with feet of clay. I'm not hugely fond of that type of character myself. I'm not big on the reluctant hero. I don't mind the anti-hero when you got a person who's who's actually kind of a bad person who is drawn into doing good things. I think that's interesting. But the guys who are just like fucking dill holes who bumblefuck into superhuman powers and then have to decide whether or not they're going to actually use those powers to improve the lot of their fellow man, I just think they're fucking limp dicks. I don't find that interesting. My heroes are people who decide that they want to care for their fellow person, who want to do good in this world. It's an active decision. It's not some sort of default, or it's not something they feel pressured into. Look, I don't have a overabundant wellspring of well wishes for my fellow man. I think that most people kind of suck. I've had enough bad experiences in my life that I just want to keep my distance from the majority of people. But I still have values and I still have ideals. And I try to find ways to benefit the world to the best of my ability and capacity. I find ways to make that happen. And I like superheroes who, whether by intent or circumstance, gain abilities to help other people. And their first inclination is, well, yeah, of course I'm going to use this to do good, to heal the universe. And one of the things I find interesting specifically about Ray Palmer, when you look at the earliest stories, he's kind of an arrogant prick. And I think that's an interesting characterization because he's a guy who is sort of a superior being. He sort of has those Randian qualities where it's like, look, I can do shit that nobody else can do. And that makes me special. And I want the qualm for that. It's not the kind of person I would necessarily want to spend time with. But within the context of a story, I find that far more interesting than a Peter Parker type. If you look at the Adams, the arc of his history, particularly his 80s stuff where he decides to fuck off and become a barbarian for a while as part of this fantasy situation, I've always associated with that with like Bill O'Reilly and those novels he wrote. You may have forgotten about. He was a private detective in these novels this guy wrote. I probably couldn't stand Ray Palmer in real life, but in stories, I appreciate the fact that he's a guy who shrinks and his ego grows as a result of that. And the fact that he's a very capable human being. He's, you know, it's one of those comic booky things where he's this absolute polymath where he's supposed to just be a physicist, but he's automatically an expert on all things science. And as a continuum segregationist, I love playing Ray Palmer against Hank Pym. Hank Pym is the guy who gets small and he's defensive about it and he's paranoid and he has psychotic breaks and he is sometimes suicidal and he has all these problems partially related to the fact that his greatest accomplishment was making himself small. And I hate the Justice League of America stories where they make Ray Palmer vocally insecure, because that's some fucking Hank Pym stuff. And what makes Ray Palmer interesting is that he gets small and he recognizes all the fucking cool shit he can do that no other hero can do. And I think somewhere in Ray Palmer's mind, he's like, I could fuck up Superman if I really needed to. And that amuses me and I respect that. Own your powers. Own your abilities. Kick that ass, Ray. But that aside, it's not like Ray Palmer is one of my absolute favorite characters. I created those fan avenues for expression in large part because other people had already been doing stuff with the Ray, with the Atom, and then they blog faded, I guess you could say. And I just wanted to maintain that. And I also had this extremely ill-considered desire to do an inter-blog crossover that was just a flaming car wreck and caused me a great deal of embarrassment and mental anguish and put people out that were helpful to me in trying to accomplish something that did not get resolved to anyone's satisfaction. And I feel badly about the people who put effort into that came to nothing. I feel bad about there being blogs out there whose final posts is related to a crossover that didn't work out. In the grand scheme of things, blogs don't mean anything, but I still feel bad about inserting myself into those areas, not allowing them to wrap up the works that they were producing as something that they wholly own. But anyway, it happened, and those blogs still exist, and my blogs and my podcast still exists, and I will continue to threaten to do more stuff with the Atom. I think he's a cool character with a great costume, and I definitely want to revisit him. This is as opposed to Al Pratt, a character who I think has a cool foreboding mask, but it otherwise. He doesn't contribute much. He's a small guy with a big chip on his shoulder. They've occasionally given him powers, but he's just not a particularly valuable contribution to the superhero community. He's this guy who always turns up in Justice Society materials because that's what Gardner Fox decided he needed to do when they brought back the Justice Society and Justice League. And I guess he had a noteworthy role in the old Justice Society of America stories. But for the most part, he's a guy who just lifted a bunch of weights, could hit people hard. It's hard to get excited about that. And his personality leaves a lot to be desired. Sorry to break with the formula for this show, but this segment's going to have to be done straight and sober. As I've been working on the Who's editing entries, I've gone down some rather deep rabbit holes of research. And while I do the solicitation copy and I do have some notes, I don't go into deep detail in those notes. While doing the research, I expect myself to hold a lot of that stuff in my head. It doesn't help, too, that I'm always wanting to foreshadow stuff that isn't necessarily going to pay off at that particular point in time. So I'll go back and I'll look at my notes, or I'll go back and look at the blurbs, and I'll realize I've completely forgotten the context for some of this foreshadowing, that there are all these fine details in these references I've made aren't sticking in my brain anymore, and then I have to pull a George R. R. Martin and go back and reread stuff to remind myself of what the whole notion was in the first place. And since I'm working on a particularly deep hole right now, I'm actually still in the process of researching as I'm recording, I thought maybe it'd be a good idea to just do a vocal note, since I'm not going to actually sit down and write this stuff down, that I can reference it later time. And even if I don't, at least through this podcast, I'll have found some way to communicate some of these findings of mine. So I never knew what a combine was. I've heard the term crime combine, but I'm not really sure what that is. It just pops up every now and again in fiction. They made references to a crime combine in the golden age of comics. I think Dollman fought one. There was an international crime combine, which Wikipedia says is a super organization made up of operatives from various other crime organizations, some based in the DC Comics universe, like Cyclops and Ogre, and other fictional organizations such as Thrush and Spectre. They opposed George, a covert agency of the United States and the Blackhawks. George, G-E-O-R-G-E, an acronym, was short for the Group for Extermination of Organizations of Revenge, Greed, and Evil, debuted in Black Hawk number 228. During that title's attempt to mainstream the Blackhawks as superheroes, known George operatives were their leader, the Long L, Mr. Delta, and the Champ, a trenchcoat-wearing robot. I don't think that Brian Michael Bendis got to that particular organization in his Leviathan story arc, so maybe I can get some use out of it. Intergang has also been referred to as a crime combine, as has the 100 or the 1000. I can't keep up with what number they're at. So these guys, this concept has been around for ages. But the one that I always remember the best was from issues of The Flash. Mark Waid, of course, had the start of his fame writing The Flash was the story arc, The Return of Barry Allen, which many Flash fans insist is the best Flash story of all time. I've personally never read the whole thing, a few bits and pieces. That was the last story arc drawn by Greg LaRocque, and he was succeeded by Mike Wieringo. And to sort of announce this and announce a new status quo for Wally West coming out of the shadow of Barry Allen, finally, they had a scarlet foil enhanced cover drawn by Alan Davis, who would continue to do covers for the Flash for at least a few months. And they gave Flash a slightly redesigned costume, a little sleeker. They took out the irises. You couldn't see his eyes anymore. He was just white. And the first story involved them bringing in the Magenta character that I guess was somebody that Wally West had dated back in the day. That story was followed by a multi-issue arc in which the Flash teamed up with his old Titans buddies, Nightwing and Starfire, who were supposed to have gotten married, but that didn't really work out. But I don't think that Wade got the note because they were acting as though they were a married couple in that one particular story. So in the story arc, the heroes are fighting a group called the Combine. And as described at the top of issue 82, once more the high-tech crime combine that rules Keystone City's underworld has gone public in hopes of drawing me out and wiping me out. Not as gutsy a move as it sounds, really. This time, their soldiers have made themselves flashproof by blanking the area with ultrasonics that affect the balance of my inner ears, making it impossible for me to run and, for that matter, to stand up straight. And so these guys have high-tech armor, and they've got, like, sci-fi cannons and tanks and stuff. And then later in the issue, when we get to see the people behind the Combine, they look like monitors, basically. The monitors from Crisis on Infinite Earths. The main guy is bald with, like, this long ponytail. He's got, like, a type knot, but it's a long long black ponytail, and he's got one of those Starfield outfits with a bunch of golden armor touches, shoulder pads, gauntlet, got a purple cape. Your typical imperious sci-fi supervillain. So the head Combine Kai recognizes Starfire as a Tamaranian. They kidnap her. They try to use her power to energize their weapons and help them retake control of Keystone City after they'd apparently lost ground to the Flash. So it seems pretty clear that at least the leader of this group is an alien himself and has an awareness of all these extraterrestrial cosmologies. At the conclusion of this three-issue story, the Combine has vowed to leave Keystone City because it's become unprofitable to continue to function there. But they are leveraging a multi-megaton time bomb to prevent the Flash from causing them any more trouble as they try to extract themselves from the city. Now, apparently this group has teleportation technology that they've used to plant the bomb somewhere in the city, but even they don't know where. So the Flash goes racing after that, while the leader of the Combine hops to his own teleporter and leaves everybody behind. In the end, Wally gets his super-powered ex-girlfriend Magenta to use her magnetism powers to shoot the bomb up into the upper atmosphere so it doesn't cause any harm. Nightwing and Starfire split, and I don't think anybody ever picked up on that story. If you go and check places like the DC Comics Wiki, they make references to the Combine within the text for descriptions of the individual issues. They don't have an entry. When I try to do searches, I don't come up with anything. It's a little frustrating in that regard. But here's where things start to get weird. Where did the idea of this Combine come from? You know, were there any particular Combines that predated this one that might have given us some information on that? Well, I didn't actually start from that point. The point where I started was in trying to check out some of the more obscure DC series of the 80s. Some of them get referenced in Who's Who, a lot of them don't. And for me, it's interesting to use this exercise to explore those areas of the DC universe that I'm not familiar with, that I would see in house ads, but never got around to actually reading myself, or maybe perhaps didn't have a desire to read prior, but had seen in quarter bins and the like. And definitely one of those books would be Haywire, which was a mature reader series. It was begun in 1988, I believe. It was one of the last books that Michael Fleischer wrote. He was also credited as a creator. The entire series was drawn by Vince Giorano, who is an artist that a lot of people have strong negative feelings about. But the miniseries doesn't really represent that style, at least in the early part of it, because he's being inked by Kyle Baker, who of course is one of the greats of left of center comics, mainstream comics, best known perhaps for Why I Hate Saturn, his breakthrough graphic novel of the 80s. But he's done a ton of work since then, and you may know him from different stuff. I always really liked his style, and I thought he was a great inker, a very 80s inker, someone who really felt like he captured that feel of that time period. And his work over Vince Giorano is transformative. It's actually a pretty good looking book on the issues he inks, which unfortunately is only maybe like the first third of the, I think it's a 12 issue maxi series, 13 issues. And it was actually intended to be an ongoing series, but you didn't read it and I didn't either. So this is a very odd, obtuse book. Feels like Fleischer was maybe trying to channel Howard Chaykin or some of the other period writers that were less inclined to give you all the information up front. The basics of the story is you got a guy who has dissociative personality disorder, essentially is living two parallel lives, unaware that this individual is two different people with two very different lifestyles. And in the minds of one of his personas, he believes that his father was murdered. In another persona, it turns out that his father is the boss of a high-tech criminal organization called the Combine. And they've developed a super suit codenamed Haywire that apparently is best exploited by somebody who has something like what we used to call multiple personality disorder. And so he uses his son as the test pilot for the device, the armor, the exosuit, whatever you want to call it. This only exacerbates this individual's disorder. And so he goes off rogue. He goes rogue. He's living these two different identities. A father and the Combine don't know where he's at, can't find him. Use people like terrorists to try to attract Haywire to recapture the suit and the son. Haywire has a pronounced lack of regard for human life, even though he's technically the protagonist of the story. People are constantly getting killed or rendered paraplegic around him. Again, it's a very 80s, hyper-violent, problematic story, you could say. Although, again, I don't think that you're necessarily supposed to have the takeaway that Haywire is the hero. The whole point is him to be very much an anti-hero, an explorer, someone who has powers like a superhuman who doesn't use those powers in the bright and shiny way that a Superman would. Another thing that's super odd about Haywire, though, is you, from the outside, would assume that this is probably a creator-owned series or it's outside of DC continuity. However, they introduced this villainess called the White Lotus. And there's another area where things get super weird, because when I was collecting trading cards, DC did a set, I don't remember what it was exactly called, but it's something about DC villains. And it was an all-painted art set. They're supposed to highlight the villains. And most of these people I was well familiar with because they were trying to capture this moment in time around 1996. I believe that the set was a spinoff of the Underworld Unleashed miniseries. And so even if you didn't know who those characters were before reading the miniseries, most of them were featured in it in some capacity. I mean, the event, was, besides being a three-issue story of its own, had multiple one-shot specials that tied into it and tied into, I think, several months worth of the majority of the DC Comics line. So there were plenty of opportunities to find out who this person, all these people were, or to have a familiarity with them. One that really stood out for me, though, was White Lotus, because she gets a card. It's a nice looking card. I have no idea who this person was. I had never encountered this person. And it turns out that they were from Manhunter, a book that was, I guess, barely still alive, or perhaps not even still alive by the time Underworld Unleashed came out. I'm not even sure if she had appearances during the Underworld Unleashed time period. I think so, because I think they ended the series as a tie-in to Underworld Unleashed. So that's probably why she was featured. She didn't end up having a lot to do, apparently, because they kill her off within Manhunter. But what's really curious about this is that the character did not debut in the Manhunter series. She debuted in the Haywire series from half a decade or more earlier. So clearly, the Haywire is not only not a creator-owned series, and I checked, the copyright is wholly DC Comics's, but it's actually, whether it was intended to at the time, retroactively became in continuity because of the ties to the Manhunter series. So the Combine had borrowed the services of a Japanese assassin who I think had some sort of high-tech armor his own self to launch against Haywire. And this assassin is supposed to work with a group called the Black Dragons. Again, these are Japanese people, and there are a number of Black Dragon societies within the greater DC Comics universe. I think one in particular came from Quality, probably from Black Hawks, that guy again. And there was, I believe, a Black Dragon society that Kurt Busiek used in The Power Company, which is the one that inspired me to use that society in previous blurbs. So now all of a sudden I've got this other connection to take advantage of. But the guy is killed by Haywire, and he turns out to be the brother of this other ninja lady, the White Lotus, and that's what they use to have her get involved with Haywire. So the girlfriend of one of Haywire's personas is killed, and after her funeral, his girlfriend and his other persona turns out to be this dominatrix with a laser whip that works for the bad guys, I think, and then this lady, Nightlash, fights White Lotus, and I guess White Lotus eventually falls in love with Haywire, and then the leather chick kind of disappears. There's a bunch of different people who have the psychic armor the same as Haywire's got, and some of them do better against them than others, but ultimately everybody ends up getting beaten, and then his father recaptures him and threatens to cut his brain out to enhance the armor, and he goes nuts and he detonates a nuke and it seems to blow up the base where his dad was, but and then also White Lotus seems like she gets gunned down, but so she turns back up again later on. It's not really convincing, and his dad doesn't really die in a convincing way either, and the armor ends up turning up in some locker at a YMCA, so it's all sort of unresolved, very weird, feels very much like one of those pothead narratives from 70s Marvel comics. Everything gets resolved, nothing gets resolved. It's a curious book. I was really tired earlier this evening, and I took a extended nap, which meant that I woke up in the middle of the night and, you know, I've got to work the next day. So it made sense for me to do what you could regard as pickup shots for this podcast. Essentially, I'm filling in gaps, filling up time that I need for the show to get out without tipping my hand to stuff that I'm doing in the comments game. And because I keep referencing that, I think it might be about time that I actually explained what it is. I've already talked at length about Siskoid going through Who's Who and forcing people who are participating in his game to take all the protagonists, all the heroic characters from that particular issue of Who's Who and spin them off in their own series. And my variation on that in the comments game is essentially the DC challenge. It's like, okay, when I went into this project, I was just throwing a bunch of shit at the wall and seeing what stuck. Then you get to the second issue of Who's Who, and it's like, okay, now that you've done that, can you expound upon that? Don't come up with another assortment of books. Figure out how to, as much as possible, continue the game that Siskoid's laid out while perpetuating the premises from the initial round. How can you actually continue these series? It's one thing to throw all a premise, but can you actually give it legs and make it continue from there? And that's essentially the point of the Comets game, is continuing the story begun in that very first edition in the Comets in my replies to what Siskoid was doing. Nobody asked me to do this, and I have no expectation that anybody's invested in it at all. I have no expectation that anybody even reads the shit that I put out there, but it scratched that itch. I always wanted to write, and I never did. and I'm not getting any younger. And it's just great fun for me to go into this thing and try to figure out the problem, figure out how all the pieces fit. Pretty much for the duration of this thing, when I'm trying to think about how to make everything work, the soundtrack in my brain is the song Schism by Tool. When I'm trying to work out the problems that are presented by trying to create a continuity out of a bunch of dumb shit that I came with for the first edition of Siskoids Who's Editing, my brain is constantly going, I know the pieces fit. I know the pieces fit. And part of the joy for me is figuring out, well, how do those pieces fit? And the happy surprises of going, well, this is my preconceived notion of who this character is or what I would want to do with this character if given the opportunity to write this character. And often throwing that shit completely out the window and going, okay, what works for this nonsense I've come up with? What's an interesting angle? What's something that nobody's done with this already? Or alternately, leaning into the derivative nature of some of this stuff. Like, for instance, I was working on one related to Green Lantern Alan Scott and his bride, Molly Maines, I think the name is, Harlequin. And I had a notion that was similar to what was done in Wonder Woman 1984 with Diana having the opportunity to reconnect with her deceased love, Steve Trevor. And because Harlequin already had a pre-existing relationship with Neron, I definitely wanted to play with that. And because that particular edition of Who's Who was looking for engagement related to Alan Scott, I thought it'd be fun to bring in the Earth 2 Alan Scott from the New 52, the homosexual one, and have her have the opportunity to basically convert therapy him via dark magic. And I don't think anybody's going to argue against Wonder Woman 1984 being a problematic movie, but because it's there and because I was playing in the same territory, rather than trying to fight it, I just turned into the skid and decided that rather than having Neron be the person who's offering up Earth 2 Alan Scott, I would just reference the Duke of Deception just as Wonder Woman 1984 did. One thing I like to do is try to bring in as much Wonder Woman stuff as possible because I'm a Wonder Woman fan, and I do think that she should have a greater impact on the broader continuity of DC Comics than she's allowed to have, in part because so much of DC continuity ignored her very existence or only barely tolerated her within the context of, say, like Justice League of America or something, rather than in her own series as her own character with her own defined parameters and concerns. So it's sort of like, fuck it. If it's going to be derivative of 1984 Wonder Woman, might as well just, you know, hang a lampshade on it and go, sure, Duke of Deception. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. They tried to goose the Atom by making a character who offered minority representation after the Brave New World one-shot that spun out of Infinite Crisis. They came up with the Orion Choi Atom. Look, here's the thing. When you have a Chinese character who shrinks and is really good at physics, you're kind of playing to model minority stereotypes. But more than that, his personality was very much in the Peter Parker vein. He's a guy who did not intend to become a superhero, who stumbles into it because of a void left by Ray Palmer. And I think most importantly, they changed the Atom costume. And the one thing you don't do is change the Atom's costume. Such a great costume. And the design was shit, and I think that John Byrne did it, and I don't know what the fuck he was thinking, because none of the alterations he made to the Atom's costume improved it in any way. And because I think that Ray Palmer inhabits a unique space within superhero comics, and Ryan Choi is, to me, fairly derivative, aside from his ethnicity, he doesn't bring anything new to the table. I just don't have a lot of use for Ryan Choi, and good stories have been done with him. Some really nice artworks were produced for him as well, but I'm never going to warm to the guy because he doesn't bring anything new to the table. When they brought in the Rhonda Pineda Atom, I was much more interested. They did make alterations to the costume, but mostly it was just a matter of her letting her have her hair flow out of the top. There are variations on the Ray Palmer costume that allowed his brown hair to come out the top as well. I don't know that it's ideal, but it's not unattractive. And I was surprised that the Ray Palmer costume more or less adapted to a female form. form. So I was actually much more amenable to Rania Pineda than Ryan Choi, also in part because the fact is Latina representation in comics is extremely poor. Cringy, I would think, would be a good adjective to apply to that. And so I had hopes for Rania Pineda. I was more enthusiastic about her making continued appearances than I ever was for Ryan Choi. And then they made her an evil Earth 3 version of the Atom and killed her off. I think they even had her stepped on, which is the most obvious robot chicken fucking way to handle a character, and I do not approve. So too bad about that. But looking back at those first entries, again, they were essentially all the elevator pitches. I didn't really have a plan for them to go anywhere. And that was a big part of the problem once they did start to go somewhere. Once I decided to continue the stories in comments from edition to edition, I done stuff like put all the Atom characters into a book called Atomic, because I thought it'd be cute and it'd be more interesting than just calling it the Atom. And then there was also an Atomic Knights book. And it's like, well, why are there two series with Atomic in the name going at the same time, starting at the same place? And at least one of them having been set up as a 12-issue maxi series, shouldn't that mean something? So that very much fed into the ongoing narrative of comic book blurbs, solicitation blurbs that have run through who's editing. All that having been said, most of what came out in volume one from me was the snowballs, the spaghetti on the walls, that kind of thing, because I had no reason to expect that this was going to be a continuing thing. And then not only does Siskoid come out with volume two of who's editing, but it comes out really fucking fast, like a month later, which I was not expecting. This seemed like the kind of project that would come out like bi-monthly or quarterly. So him knocking it out that quickly kind of jump-started me.
Your hair is beautiful tonight. Make it magnificent tonight. Make it right. Make me tonight. Atomic. We think you're special. 7JBCKSCKR2VU. The 108 Sage. Austin. Dr. Ange. Canoes. Chris Dunford. Chris Litton. Chris Thompson. Dave's Comic Heroes Blog. Debosh. Del Dracula. Dear Cashton, who added thanks ours. P. Ed Moore. El Romero Mero. FKA Jason. Fanhills Podcast. Friends Talking Fantasy Podcast. The Hammers. Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hicks, Xapainchop, Ignatia, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jesus Ries, JMT Prod, Jeffrey Brown, Jerry Hyde, Jimmy Jam, John is Feeling Much Better, Juan Pablo Trejo, KSCGSF Podcast, Keith G. Baker, Kenny Crowley Jr., Lucretia, Martin Gray, Mike It Send Aliens to Me, Minizera Mepta, Prairie Justice, A Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast, Psyche, Randy Call. Caldwell, Collard Green Lantern, Raven X Fields, Resurrections, An Adam Warlick and Thanos Podcast, Rev Bookburn, Richard Field, Royce Miller, Sean Phillips, Siskoid, TAC.T, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tasmia Muller, Tim Price, The Podcrasher, Tora, Trekker Talk, Afda, Wild Dog Podcast, and Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace Podcast.